Accession number 6395, Rio 1.
Mr. Spears, Rio 1. When were you captured, Mr. Spears?
In June 1942, 2 days after the fall of Tobruk in the Western Desert.
And which unit were you serving with?
I was a signal officer to 11th Indian Infantry Brigade.
And what rank did you hold?
I was a lieutenant.
So what were your duties with the unit?
To provide the communications between brigade headquarters and the infantry battalions and artillery units, which formed part of the brigade. We were under the command of the 2nd South African Division.
How long had you been in Tobruk?
I suppose perhaps a fortnight to 3 weeks. The brigade had been in reserve and was brought up to reinforce 2nd South African Division in the defence of Tobruk, at a time when Rommel was advancing, and it was done in rather a rush, and the decision, I believe, to hold Tobruk was taken fairly late on in the day, and we were put in, as I said, to strengthen the 2nd South African Division and to hold the eastern part of the eastern third of the perimeter.
Can you describe to me the circumstances of your capture?
Yes. After the surrender of the force, those of us who had been driven out of our headquarters escaped down to the coast and hid in the caves west of the harbour for the rest of the daylight hours on the 21st. And that night I teamed up with some South African other ranks and offered to try to lead them out of the fortress, which was by this time in German hands. We started that night to cross through the area south of the port, right round to the east, to the Pilestrino Road, near where the divisional headquarters had been. We then hid up for the rest of that night in a dugout under the road. The following morning, we were flushed out of this by a party of Germans, and I was forced to bury my revolver and other weapons before leaving the dugout. And once we were outside, we were told to walk down the road to the cage which had been formed for prisoners. They had no troops to spare to escort us, so we wandered off down there and realized that we still weren't effectively captured. So as soon as we were out of sight, we diverted and went round to some caves I knew of on the west side of the harbour, where we stocked, which were store caves, and we stocked up with provisions and remained there for that night, or at least until late that night. And that's the 22nd. Then we started to work our way along the coast of the shore. It was, in fact, the area of the brigade I'd been in, so I knew the ground fairly well, heading for the eastern edge of the perimeter. And at about 2 in the morning, I went through a what had been a transport camp with the vehicles dispersed fairly widely. Of course, the moon was occasionally clouded over, and I failed to see that the Germans had parked their vehicles alongside the burnt-out remnants of ours for air cover, and we were suddenly challenged by a sentry who fired on us. And I tried to grapple with him when while the others went up to him, but it didn't work, and so we were captured and put under guard for the rest of the night and sent into the cage in Tobruk the following morning, where the Germans handed us over to the Italians, that being their agreement with the Italians at that time, that all prisoners taken in the desert were handed over to Italy.
How did the Germans treat you when you were first captured?
Perfectly correctly. The German officer, they tried to find out which one of us it had been who tried to grapple with the sentry, but the men I was with remained loyal to me and said, oh, he must have made a mistake or misunderstood or something. So they didn't pursue that, fortunately. The German officer said, you'd better put your watch in your boot or somebody will take it off you, which I thought was a kindly gesture. One was greeted, of course, by the usual phrase, for you the war is over. And he said, you wouldn't have lost the fortress if the Australians had still been here, but they've gone, which rather amused me. I had to conceal my amusement because I knew there was still an Australian division back in the Delta area. In general, they treated us well.
Was the German officer referring to the Italians when he said, keep your watch in your shoe?
Yes. Or we were not only guarded by Italians, of course. At a later stage, the Senussi Arabs who were working for the Italians at that time were put on to guard us, and there were some fairly unscrupulous customers amongst them.
What did relations seem to be between the Germans and Italians as far as you could see?
I couldn't really see. There was no clear contact from which to judge at that stage. And at later stages in Italy, there were some interesting points about that.
Was there any attempt to interrogate you personally?
Not at that stage, no. There were 30,000 in the cage at that time.
Had you made any kind of preparations for being captured, any contingency plans?
None at all. I'd never believed it would happen to me. I thought I would either carry on or be killed. When these four South African troops came into the cave where I was hiding, where I first met them, I can remember hiding behind the rocks and loading the revolver and automatic I had and just thinking I must sell my life dearly. But of course they wandered in and I said, when I saw who they were, I said, you're bloody lucky not to have been shot. But no, I had made no preparations at all.
What was your psychological condition once you realized you were definitely captured?
I think in common with all who were captured, I was completely dazed, in a state of shock, incapable of thinking very much for quite a long time. I very quickly got stomach upsets and there were difficult conditions and one had to exist, and that was one's primary objective, I think.
Was there any tendency amongst those who had been captured at Tobruk to look around for people to blame for what had happened?
Yes. I think that whilst we had great confidence in the South African troops as a whole and as individuals, most of us blamed the South African General Klopper for his decision to surrender, not only for the fact that he decided to surrender, but for the time at which he did so.
Why that particular time did you have in mind?
Well, what I say comes from the Brigadier Anderson, of 11th Brigade, who went early, just before dawn on the 21st, to division headquarters to find out what was to happen. We were beginning to dig slip trenches because we knew we'd be stukered that morning, or as soon as daylight came. And as he came back to our position with the brigade major, Major Abbott, I could hear him swearing in Scots from quite a distance. And he said that General Klopper had been in radio contact with the army commander the previous night and had been told by General Ritchie to, quote, save all he could. And Klopper, said Anderson, had interpreted that as to save all the lives he could, whereas, of course, we felt that he had meant to save all the troops he could for the cause. And we still had the Cameron Battalion and the Gurkhas of our brigade fighting at that point. The fact that the Germans had broken into the fortress and were behind us was of no serious worry. I mean, all-round defence was very much a part of military tactics in the desert, and you were not worried if you were cut off. You just fought back in all directions, and I think we felt that he should have put up a bigger fight for it. But there it was. The Camerons were very interesting. They were all Camerons, everyone. They were all named Camerons, practically the whole battalion. But they continued to fight for, I think, 3 or 4 days until they ran out of ammunition. They then left the CO told people that he intended to surrender the following morning so as to give people time to go off in the hours of darkness, and Klopper failed to do this. He didn't tell Anderson until early on the 21st. Consequently, we had a whole day in which we had to survive if we wanted to get out and take advantage of the darkness. And this was a further ground for complaint. Anderson, on the other hand, sent out all who could go on foot through the lines in the hours of darkness a day or so later, and then the following morning he asked for his wounded to be taken out, and the Germans, who'd been very impressed with the defence that the Camerons had put up, agreed to that, and they were finally allowed by the Germans to march out of their positions with the honours of war. I think it's the only occasion on which this happened in the Second World War. They marched out with their weapons from their positions and in formation and halted when they got to the German positions piled arms and fell out. It was an orderly surrender, and I think the only occasion on which the honours of war were given to anybody in the Second World War. Certainly the only one I know of.
What were physical conditions like in the cage?
The cage consisted of a very long length of Dannert coil barbed wire on the ground, surrounding an area in which we were just sort of sitting on the desert. There was nothing else. No tents or anything of that sort.
And what about food and sanitation?
Certainly no sanitary arrangements. You just did it as where you were. Food, I forget, at different hours. We didn't stay there very long. The officers were taken off by truck after 48 hours or so, but the men I'm afraid, suffered great hardship because they were made to march into captivity, which was at least 200 miles, I'd have thought, through Derna to Bachi.
Where were you taken to personally?
I was personally taken by truck with Senussi guards to Derna, where we stayed one night, and then we were moved on to a camp at Bachi, which is not far from Benghazi.
What impression did you get of the Senussi guards?
They were pretty wild merchants. They were desert tribes who had the misfortune of being transferred from one side to the other at different times, and survival had to be their middle name. And they were pretty rough, but nobody was actually killed. There was a certain amount of rifle butts and that kind of thing, but there was Italian supervision. There was an Italian under officer or lieutenant, I forget frankly very much about it, except that it was the first time in Derna, it was the first time that I began to feel something of what it was like to be a prisoner, to be held with a number of other people sitting on the floor of a room with a guard at the door. One became conscious of the fact, an armed guard, one became conscious of the fact that you simply didn't know what was going on outside that door, and your freedom to go and see what was happening in the next room didn't exist. This claustrophobic feeling that a prisoner gets, that he only knows what he can actually see or where he's allowed to go. What happens elsewhere is unknown to him.
What happened to you at Bache?
There we were again in the open, and though we managed to make ourselves tents, there were some ground sheets issued, which the Italian ground sheet could be made into a sort of bivouac tent, and we lived in an open space there with a standpipe for water. There was a perpetual queue at it, needless to say, filling our own water bottles and being fed twice a day on sort of risotto kind of food. A curious contrast was the fact that in these rather rough conditions, and of course many people were sick, there was a lot of diarrhea and that kind of thing, dysentery, to see an Italian guard with an accordion playing singing O Sole Mio struck an extraordinary contrast with the other privations.
What did the general demeanour of your Italian captors seem to be?
At that stage, they were their morale was quite high. The Rommel and the Italian forces had advanced past Tobruk. They'd captured Tobruk, and they were going on, and they believed they were going to get to the desert. They had not reached El Alamein, and so they were in quite good shape.
And their demeanour towards you?
It was quite correct. I didn't see any examples of brutality at that time. Frontline soldiers, I think, are usually the best. And, of course, one notices a change between the treatment of prisoners by frontline soldiers and those of the sort of support and rear areas.
How long were you at Bache?
I have no clear idea, really. I've tried to check that, but I suppose I must have been there at least 3 or 4 weeks. We were being ferried out in small numbers by air from Benghazi and by the Italians, and one waited one's turn.
Did you leave by air yourself?
Yes. I was taken with a group of about, I suppose, 20, 25 others to Benghazi, and we were put on a Savoia bomber, or a cargo plane, sorry, and flown to Lecce in the heel of Italy.
Were you apprehensive about the air journey?
I think one was too dazed to be seriously apprehensive. I have a recollection of sitting on a sort of canvas seat thing along the side of the aircraft. Of course, the doorway of the aircraft remained open throughout the flight, and there was a machine gun mounted in it. And certainly the possibility of air attack did cross one's mind, but I think it would have been a fairly remote possibility, because we'd been forced back to the Delta, and we were by this time more or less out of range of a British attack.
So you hadn't seen much Allied air activity around Barcher?
No, no. It would have been we were very far back. We'd been pushed very far back by that point.
Was Lecce a regular POW camp or a transit camp?
No, we were housed overnight in a big school building adjoining the church, in quite good conditions, really. It was a it had been a school.
So how long were you kept there?
Overnight only, and then we were put on the train to Bari, where there was a regular transit camp for prisoners.
What were conditions like there?
A series of huts and not too bad, really. Of course, you could never have enough food as a prisoner, because you have no means of being sure of going and getting some more. I think it's a psychological thing rather than anything else. And it was at Bari that I first saw a Red Cross parcel. And I remember the immense excitement that this generated. This was the first evidence that one's own side cared about one and was able to do something. And the sight of a Roundtree's cocoa tin really was the first thing that woke me up from the sort of state of isolation and shock I'd been in. We had packets of sun-made raisins. There were only one parcel in 10 prisoners, and we solemnly dealt out the currants in the packet of raisins between 10 of us, so that each should have exactly the same number. But it was a very striking thing, and the Red Cross contribution to our welfare remained very basic, very visceral, right up to the end of our captivity.
Was it just officers at Bari, or...?
Just officers.
Was there any kind of organisation amongst the POWs there?
Not at that stage, no. There was some... there was a lot of talk about lists of names. These were made for broadcasting by Vatican Radio, And this it was at this point that that we gave our names in, so that Vatican Radio could inform our people that we were alive.
What was morale like at that stage?
I don't think it existed until, as I say, the Red Cross parcels arrived. That brought people back to life a little bit, and organization then became possible. And when we came to the permanent camp, which we did after 2 or 3 weeks in Bari, we were taken by train up to a new regular camp at a place called Chieti, near Pescara, Camp 21, PG 21. And there, of course, organizations started to appear. And
what did it consist of?
Well, there were about there were six big bungalows. They were properly built bungalows with concrete floors and concrete and block built, you know, sort of proper buildings. And each of them housed 200 to 300 prisoners in barrack rooms, with a center aisle running down through these barrack rooms, washing facilities, and a separate cookhouse and bathhouse at the end of the camp, and a big high wall all round it with barbed wire and the rest, and sentry boxes and so forth. And the senior British officer was identified, and he became the SBO, so-called. And a small camp block office or staff was formed amongst the colonels and majors in each of these six bungalows, and a room or barrack room leader was appointed, so that we had some means of communication and means of organization.
Who appointed the room leader?
I think it just fell to the senior officer that happened to be present in that room.
Can you remember who yours was?
A captain, Kerens, Pat Kerens, I think I'm right in that. We were tending to sort of make contact with friends, you know, sort of to make friends at this stage, and some form of organization was appearing.
Did the camp develop any outstanding personalities amongst the POWs?
Quite a few, some quite interesting personalities. We had a number of professional actors who started up theatre and musical companies. We had two competing companies, and some interesting. There was one member of the Tennant family, you know, the big theatre family in the Cambion Tennant, and people started writing plays, when new prisoners arrived who happened to know the latest tunes, there were people who could listen to them whistling it and then make an arrangement to back up the melody so that the tune could be played. We acquired instruments, I think through the Red Cross again, musical instruments, so that a chap called Tommy Sampson, who's a well-known trumpeter, was also a prisoner, and Tony Baines, who'd been on a BBC orchestra, ran the orchestra. So there's a lot appeared in that sense, a lot of personalities developed there. One rather interesting personality a man named Charlie Wilmot, an officer. When we arrived in the camp one morning, he came walking down through the passage between the barrack rooms, shouting out, "Only another 153 more weeks in the bag." And the next, everybody said, "Shut up, get out." Next week, on the same day, he came down through the barrack rooms saying, "Only another 152 more weeks in the bag." And he continued to do this right the way through our time in Italy. And at the time when